Welcome to this week's Kesterberis podcast with a K, available on Kesterberis, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and Audio Boo.
Oh, yes, ladies and gentlemen, turn off your glow sticks. And put the person you were dancing with down. It is the podcast Derberis with a P and a K and lots of mixed introductions. My name is Christian Corley. Hello, how are you? I got slightly excited by the theme tune there, as you can probably tell. And with me are James McLean and Brian Terranova.
I was getting flashbacks listening to the theme tune as if we were back at school. It's like in the, I don't know, fourth year primary school, and we were sitting in sort of the reading room with a television, and they're putting one of the BBC One learning school programs on, and it'd be called something like Learning to Read, and it'd have that music on. It'd be really exciting jazzy electro music, and ultimately it would come up with those words in some really big thick BBC block font, Learning to Read.
I couldn't concentrate to the nice music because I was wondering when you hired someone to impersonate me.
He's good, isn't he?
Yeah,
he's very good.
I mean, it's a little weird. It's a little, you know, it's not perfect, but, you know, it's good. It's good.
Yes.
Could have just asked me, but whatever.
You ever seen the Space 1999 episode, Brian the Brain?
Really? No, I've not seen that. I've seen one Space 1999 episode.
Oh, you'll have to see that one. Brian the Brain is voiced by a certain Cribbins.
Cribbins.
Yeah.
I haven't seen any Space 1999 episodes, but I have seen Doppelganger.
Oh. Right.
Which I think is based on Space 1999. Is that right? Or is it got a similar plot or something to that? It's about a twin Earth at the other side of the sun that we can't see. And it's got the same guy in it, Space 1999, whose name escapes me at the moment. Or do I mean UFO? I forget. Well, basically what happens is, you know that American guy?
Well, Landau?
No, Ed.
Ed, so UFO.
Right, okay. So both planets launch a mission to the other planet at the same time, because it's basically an absolute mirror. So they both planets think the guy turned around halfway through the mission. And then it follows one of them and everything's in a mirror. Interesting film.
I've never heard of that. I need to watch that now.
Yeah, check that out. It's good. It's good.
Maybe.
No, it's genuine. It's genuine.
I haven't watched Space 1999. I have to still make sure I look like a sci-fi aficionado. I better quickly make up something. A doppelganger.
No, doppelganger is real. It's absolutely real. It is totally real.
Right, okay, so...
Now, see, what I'm going to have to do is talk to you slightly condescendingly for a moment whilst I Google it, you see, whilst you're doing the same thing.
Well, look, I'm just doing it now to prove that this film does not... Oh, it does exist.
Yes, exactly.
Right, yeah.
It's a good film.
The good thing, James, is that right now you can say, if you rewind the tape, you'll find out that I, in fact, said that it did exist. Because you know no one is going to rewind the tape. Who listens to the podcast twice? Come on.
I do.
Just rewind, everybody. You can hear that. James was with us. Actually, Christian, I know nothing about what both of them are talking about, but still.
Oh, right. So Doppelganger Nick Courtney's in it. Film prior to UFO.
Yeah, Nick Courtney's in it as well. Which shows you how long ago it is since I've seen it, because I didn't realise Nick Courtney was in it. But I thought the UFO guy was in it. I don't think he is.
Yep, he is. Ed Bishop.
He is. I can't see him in the list of casting.
Ed Bishop.
Right, okay, yeah. Herbert Lom's in it as well, and Philip Maddock.
Philip Maddock, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, Philip.
Yeah, and George Sewell
anyway,
as well.
So... Yeah, well, maybe we should stop reading.
Yes, and this is a great podcast. There. Hey, the podcast where people are reading.
I was enjoying it, guys. You can keep going on.
Cool. Well, hey, listen, what have you been doing at the weekend, podcast team? Assemble.
Oh, my God. I have been spring cleaning.
Is that like jumping up and down and cleaning, or is that a different thing?
Well, okay, you guys don't do spring cleaning? Okay.
Yeah, we do, yeah.
Okay, spring cleaning, yeah. Now, I have done that. I have changed out a lighting fixture. I have changed out a sink and a cabinet. And honestly, my weekend, which should have been full of fun stuff, was full of all that kind of work stuff. But you know what? It's all the better for it. So yeah,
okay, when you say changed out,
I did productive
things. When you say changed out, do you mean you replaced them or you just cleaned them?
I replaced them. I bought all new ones, replaced the fixtures and fittings.
That's impressive. Yeah. That's not cleaning. That's DIY.
Well, I did cleaning as well. I did DIY and cleaning as well. There was a lot of stuff. I basically have become a pack rat, and I had far too much crap that needed to go. And at the same time, things needed to be upgraded. So there you go.
You're a pack rat. I didn't know you could sing.
Yeah, well, hey, man, of course. I was part of the gang. I was the one they never showed on film.
Okay.
I don't know why. There's no reason. I have no idea why they did that. But, you know, they tell me it was a cool thing. It was like an Easter egg for people when they find out about it. Apparently, that's what they said.
Okay. And McLean, what have you been doing other than ejecting German terrorists from the Nakatomi Tower?
Ejecting. I was wondering what you were going to say then. Which would have made a far more funny sentence.
I don't think so.
Probably not. Not for them anyway. I've been... I've been searching through online archives for various little bits and bobs for various papers. I just came across one today which just interests me. I was looking through some older archives, BBC online archives. There's a little...
Do you remember That's Life?
Yes, I do.
When you started your little piece there, it was like that old bloke that they used to have on That's Live telling us how he'd been flicking through the local press lately and found this amusing headline.
They probably had a very similar theme tune to us as well. Let's clarify here before I offend Russell. I do really like the theme tune. it's just giving me flashbacks to the 80s, which I think is actually the intention. So,
I think it's very kind of modern.
Do you? I like it. When we had it today, I was just listening and I was thinking, I could just see this on so many.
I think it's a multi-layered theme. There's a lot going on in there.
Bass line, which comes from something I can't think where, it just feels like something you'd see kicking off Tomorrow's World or something in 1989, because I have a love for the 80s and of 80s music, is very up my street.
Okay. So that was your weekend.
Yes.
What about yours?
Well, did you know I met Terence Dix?
Get out of town.
No, really, I did. And actually, I haven't mentioned this previously. I was going to mention this on Twitter, but I didn't get around to it. Or Instagram, rather, I should say. So, face the microphone, Corley. I travelled slightly unprepared because I forgot to take a book by Terence Dix. So I hot-footed it to Forbidden Planet and found a copy of Doctor in the Cave Monsters, the new edition, which obviously by Malcolm Hulk, but has an introduction by Terence. And I asked him to sign it for Bruce, my little boy. So I don't like getting autographs, really. I find them personally as slightly... I don't know if facile is the right word, but I'm not particularly interested in having autographs, but I like getting messages from other people.
Is what you've just said is by verbatim exactly what Bruce will say in 20 years' time on a hypercast about this book that his dad got him.
On the Hypercast. Hypercast, I like that. So basically, it says to Bruce, carry on reading, Terence Dix. Now, we'll come back to this a little bit more later on. So I'm going to give that to Bruce when he's a bit older and read it to him and everything. And then he can keep it when he's, you know, when he can read and have his own book collection. It'll sit there in his book collection. But it reminded me of another autograph that I once got for someone. Do you remember this, Brian?
Which?
Paul McGann.
No.
Yeah, Brian, do you remember Paul McGann?
I remember Paul McGann.
Yeah, do you remember when we met Paul McGann?
I'm sorry? Yes.
You remember when we met Paul McGann? We got his got his autograph.
Yes.
And Anthony Dry was with us. That's the same Anthony Dry who, despite assuring me he would be at an afternoon with Terence Dix at the Fab Cafe in Manchester yesterday, decided he'd rather watch Liverpool get beaten by Aston Villa in the FA Cup semi-final.
Just carry on, Corley. Just keep offending everyone that we know.
Yeah.
Roll it out. Just take out every single contact that this, this website has. No problem. We don't care. We just spend our free time.
Never mind. Never mind. Anyway, so yeah. And so there was three of us, and Anthony was trying to get Paul McGann to join us in the pub to watch Arsenal play Liverpool in another big game some years ago. It wasn't the FA Cup, though, I don't think. Anyway, and so we were there, and we were chatting with him, and you got his autograph, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, I did. Well, you know, my thing is, I'm with you. I don't like to do autographs. But in the line, it was an autograph line, and I just wanted to say hi, and I wanted to thank him for doing the big finish plays and so on, but I didn't feel right standing in line doing that, so I just had he and Sylvester McCoy and Daphne Ashbrook sign the convention pamphlet, because the autograph didn't matter to me. I just wanted to meet them and say hi, you know?
Sure. So what I did, I asked him to write a message for Kerry, which was basically telling her to watch Withnail and I, because she wouldn't watch it.
Nice.
She refused to watch it because she got bored in like the first 20 minutes. Now, since then, she's watched it a lot more than she has. So it clearly worked, this tactic. Although when I told Paul McGann that she wouldn't watch it, he told me to dump her. So there you go. Yeah. So Paul, if you're listening, your signature worked better than the advice. Of course, Paul McGann's listening.
I'm sure it won't be by the end of it.
Yeah, so that's what I did. I met Terence Dix. I also managed not to upset Terence. You'll be gratified to know. I also met Michael Herbert. I also met Michael Herbert, who was on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and who wrote the pamphlet on Malcolm Hulk being a communist. Doing the comments, which I've got a copy here, which I'll be reading this evening. That's my bath time reading this week.
You met Cavanna?
Yeah, I had a chat with Gareth about a couple of minor things. I provided IT support for the event as well when he had trouble running the DVD player.
Oh dear.
yes, that's what happens when you're slightly techie, people call on you. But all in all, it was really good.
When you sit perpetually in an era of Crossroads and Nymon, is that you don't keep up with the technological, improvements.
Have you watched that episode of Crossroads?
Spools.
Have you watched that episode?
No, I want to. I do intend to.
it's an experience.
I miss Crossroads. I remember it as a kid. You see, so
yeah. Well, do you know what I remember most about it? I didn't really remember. So I remember the fire. And I also remember the end titles used to sweep in from the left and the right. They were clearly, they were superimposed, and they must have been stuck onto the side of a block, which they would then turn in front of the camera and then flip over and turn and whatever, what have you.
To the sound of our music.
Nearly, yeah. Oh, Brian, if you've never seen Crossroads, don't.
Good advice. No, I have not seen it.
No, don't. You don't want to, really. It's really, really bad.
Is this another one of your soap operas?
It's yeah. They cancelled it a few years ago. They cancelled it in the late 80s, and then they brought it back briefly a few years ago. It was kind of the big thing that Freema Agyeman had done before Doctor Who.
Huh.
The revival, but the revival didn't last particularly. In fact, I think the revival turned out to be someone's dream.
Huh.
If I remember rightly. But anyway, so yeah, that's what I did at the weekend. I met Terence Dix, went to the an afternoon with Terence Dix at the Fab Cafe in Manchester. Very interesting talk by Terence. The guy was going for about at least an hour, and I've recorded it, and I'll be sharing bits and bobs of it with you, dear listener, over the next few weeks. We're going to start today with a discussion, actually with the Q&A from the end, because the talk was really about Terence Dix talking about Malcolm Hulk and Mac's work at the prior to joining Doctor Who and what he did on Doctor Who. So here's the Q&A.
Well, I'm conscious we've talked long enough, so it's perhaps time to open up to the floor to a couple of you guys, if anyone has a question for Terence. Yes, sir.
You mentioned about the ideal story being four episodes. I mean, yes. Are we kidding ourselves that a modern audience can't take cliffhangers anymore? Because obviously the modern series very rarely does it.
Yeah, I mean, people ask me about, you know, the new show and what I think of it, and it's a whole different ballgame, you see, because we were almost uniquely a series of serials. You know, we do four or five series. And I like the 25-minute length, you know, you have to zip it along, end with a cliffhanger, get on watching next week, but that's now a thing of the past, you know. In the current show, they've got to do the whole thing, usually if it's one story, they've got to do the whole thing in, what, 50 minutes, 45, 50 minutes. Things zip along, nothing is ever properly explained, you don't know what the hell's going on half the time, but they don't have the time, you know, I mean, the other thing was, you know, it's a constant pace, which is fine, but I think can occasionally be a bit wary, you know, for the audience. I mean, we had, you know, like sometimes we had like little lulls or quiet bits in the story, you know, and sometimes just to make up the time. I mean, Joran was used to say to me, look at the script and say, tell us, where are my moments of charm? I must have a moment of charm. And I'd write him a little scene where he chatted to Joe or the Brigadier or something, you know, and that was his moment of charm. They don't have time for moments of charm now, you know, it's all whizzing along.
Hello.
So, perhaps understandably, you didn't want commercials for dog food or perhaps Crossroads on your gravestone. So what would you have?
Sorry, well, on my tombstone?
Yes, you said you didn't want Crossroads and you didn't want dog food, so...
Right, so I think he's been harsh on Crossroads.
Right, the second had, I told you I was ill.
George may live, could
have been. No, I wouldn't have that, I would... He was a professional. And that's what that's what I've been all my life.
That's good.
Tackled each job and done the best I can with it, you know. And, that's good enough. That's as good as you can be.
I have another one. I see you're doing a sequel to Horror of Frank Rock.
See, that's another one. I sold them a story about vampires. The bee, which later did come to pass as State of Decay. I mean, in the years when I left Doctor Who, they would very occasionally, come back to me. Occasionally, because John Nathan Turner hated me, but occasionally, perforce, if they got into a crisis and they needed something reliable and okay and quick, they would come to me. So every now and again, I got asked for it to do a show, and I told them I've always been very fond of vampires, and I told them a story about vampires and written the first couple of episodes, everything going well. When an edict came down from the top floor of the BBC, they were at the time doing a prestige adaptation of Dracula with Sir Laurence Olivier playing Van Helsing. You know, you can't get more prestige than that. And they issued an order saying, no vampires on Doctor Who. People will think you are making fun of us. And suddenly, you know, my vampires got cancelled. And crisis meeting, you know, Bob called me in for a crisis meeting, taken over from the script editor. And he said, what are we going to do? And I said, I know, what do you want to do? And he said, well, Terrence, I've always wanted to do a story set on a lighthouse. And I said, Bob, I know bugger all about lighthouses. And he said, go out and buy the Boy's Book of Lighthouses and learn and write me a script set on a lighthouse, which is pretty much what I did, you know.
But if we're looking at a sequel, everyone's dead.
There is that, but there are some people, believe it or not, who are doing kind of follow-up novels and are doing a book based on Fang Rock. With a prequel, I think a prequel and a sequel or something like that. God knows how, you know. I just wish them the best of luck. Let them get on with it.
Right. Well, yes, Paul.
I read recently that there were a radio show that you were supposed to be writing way back for Doctor Who. One, is all that true? Because I've not heard about it before. But if it were true, what was it?
Yeah, the very first thing I ever sold commercially was a radio play, which was a sort of, I think it was called A Criminal Practice, and it was a thriller, radio thriller, crime thriller, sort of a comedy thriller. And I got a book on, this was, I think, before I met Mac, and I got a book on radio script layout, and I wrote it, in more or less the right form, sent it in, and much to my surprise, about 3 months later, I got a call back from somebody saying, I forget his name now, he said, but I'm a director of the BBC, and we like to wee play, I think we're going to do it. And that was my first ever sale of anything. £100 they paid me for that, and that was big money in those days. And I did a couple of radio
years rent at Max, isn't it?
I did a couple of radio plays, and I did a comedy series with a writer called Peter Reeves. Oh, and I did a comedy series called Joey with Alfred Bass and Harry Fowler. So, yeah, those were kind of early days things, but radio is a good place to start because they don't pay very much money, and so they have to use more people. And Frank Muir of Muir and Norton said, everybody needs a place to be lousy in. And we were lousy in radio for years. Well, I was lousy in radio. Well, not too lousy, I hope, in radio. But everybody wants to go in television, because the money's better, obviously.
Well, we've got time for one more question. There's, oh, gosh, three hands. Right, we'll squeeze in three. Go on, then. Gentleman in the white there.
I was just wondering what your thoughts were on the idea of a series showrunner and how the idea of showrunners kind of affected the dynamic between script editor and producer.
I'm very much in favour of it. I mean, I know Steve Moffat quite well. In a sense, I can claim to have done that to some extent, purely because of Barry Letts, who was the producer. Now, the producer is the supreme authority on the show, isn't it? But Barry and I got... Barry was my best friend for 30-odd years, And we got on so well. And Barry always treated me as a colleague and an equal. And he'd say... he'd never say, I'm doing this. He'd say, we're doing this, So... And the thing about script editing, you see, you're not in the chain, which is my job then, you're not in the chain of command, which is producer-director. So what the script editor's job is very much what you make of it. And I've known script editors who clear up the teacups after a meeting, if you're not given, status or respect. But I was very lucky because people knew how closely Barry and I worked, and I got kind of added clout, from the fact that people knew if I said something and they went to Barry, Barry would almost certainly back me up, And we kind of worked as one. So I had to some extent, I had that experience of being, or at least a joint showrunner with Barry, because we used to. And I think that's what you need. The one sort of caveat I'd add to that is that I've always said that everybody in a position of authority needs somebody he has to listen to. Doesn't necessarily have to do what they say, but he has to listen to him, consider his arguments, counter them. And Barry and I did that for each other. We talked each other off. Stephen, I think, hasn't got anybody. I mean, Stephen's in sole charge, and he's a brilliant writer and does very well. But for instance, that show where the moon is a giant monster. If I'd been around then and he'd come up with that, I'd have said, now come on. Let's be serious. But nobody to say it, you see. So it swings around about.
All right. Gentlemen at the back there.
TV writers nowadays tend to have a lot higher profile than names, for instance, Stephen Merowitz.
TV writers have a much higher. Could you speak up, sir?
Sorry. TV writers now have a higher profile, the likes of Stephen and Paul Abbott and so on. Do you think Mac and Bob Holmes and so on got the credit they deserved?
No, I don't think he did. I mean, Mac was always treated as a run-of-the-mill journeyman writer, a man you could go to for a script and he wouldn't let you down, And I think he was reasonably happy with that, as I was myself, really. But really, script writers, either radio or television, I mean, I noticed an enormous jump in my status when I started writing books. Nobody ever asks for your autograph when you, when you write television, but when you write books, you know, they're there and they're permanent and they're kind of more respectable. And that does give you added status. So, but television and radio scriptwriters are not much regarded, sadly.
Well, I suppose you then had something physical for them to sign as well. There was nothing for them to sign. This is true. So one last question, which is Michael, who's of course started off our journey.
I'll just read something I received this morning. I'm teaching a course on Doctor Who in Stockport at the college. I'm teaching a course about Doctor Who at Aquinas College, and I contacted Michael Troughton as we're dealing with his dad on Tuesday, and Michael kindly sent me this, so I'd like to share it with you. He says, "I know my dad would be very honoured, if not a little amazed, to be included in such a course. After all, he did say right at the beginning of rehearsals for The Power of the Daleks, without Bill, it probably lasted 6 weeks. How wrong he was. It still survives today, stronger, and just as popular as ever. In fact, I was so pleased to be able to fulfil a childhood dream and appear in the Christmas special last year. What an emotional experience that was. It took me back to those heady days of studio visits to the Web of Fear set and seeing Yeti and Daleks. I was just 12 years old then. I think if it hadn't been for the wonderful new character he was able to create, the Doctor, so different and above all believable, we would never have enjoyed an incredibly talented Doctor as he followed. We have a lot to thank him for."
Thank you, Michael.
What's your question?
I suppose the question is, isn't Troughton a genius?
Yes, undoubtedly.
Well, thank you very much. That's the end of our first part. There's a few things just to go through. We have, we're now going to announce the winner of our general election Malcolm Hulk episode, which we'll then show. We'll have a short break while it's on. After that, Terence will be here to sign any bits and bobs. Please no wheelbarrows full of Target novelisations. And of course, Michael will be here selling his excellent pamphlet, Doctor Who and the Communist. And I'm also delighted to say that the artist, Paul Cook, has prepared 13 prints, so one for each Doctor, naturally, of the illustration you see behind us. So they're all available for £5 each, and all of the proceeds will be going to the Alzheimer's Society. So a very good cause and a great memento of what I hope you'll agree has been a great afternoon.
So that's just a small flavour of an afternoon with Terence Dix. Was it afternoon or audience? It was brilliant anyway, whichever. And lots of people, full house in the Fab Cafe, really good atmosphere in there too. And nice to see some people there and have a bit of a chat with people. Now, I've had an email from Candy Jar, from Sean at Sean Russell at Candy Jar, who was on the podcast a few weeks ago with Andy Frank and Marlon and Hannah Haysman, when we were discussing the Lethbridge Stewart series. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do indeed.
Thought you might. Well, today, and it's Monday when we record this, so by the time you hear this on sort of Wednesday, Thursday, it will already be revealed. They've released the cover for the Lethbridge Stewart, The Schizoid Earth by David A. McKinty. And there's a small synopsis. Lethbridge Stewart was supposed to be in the mountains of the East. Things didn't quite go according to plan. On the eve of war, something appeared in the sky, a presence that blotted out the moon. Now it has returned, and no battle plan can survive first contact with this enemy. Plagued by nightmares of being trapped in a past that never happened, Lethbridge Stewart must unravel the mystery of a man 10 years out of his time, a man who cannot possibly exist. Why do the ghosts of fallen soldiers still fight long-forgotten battles against living men? What is the secret of the rural English town of Deepdene? Lethbridge Stewart has good reason to doubt his own sanity. But is he suffering illness or injury? Or is something more sinister going on? So that's out in June. David McKinty has written a few Doctor Who books over the years, as well as Star Trek and Space 1999, apparently. I didn't know there were Space 1999 novels.
Yes, there are.
Yeah, right. He wrote The Face of the Enemy, which was a Brigadier-centric novel in 1993. Mm-hmm. He also did First Frontier, which reintroduced the Master, also for Virgin. Have you read any of this, James?
he did White, was it White Darkness, the Haitian one? The one with Haitian zombies for Virgin?
Right, that rings a bell. I don't have a...
He's done a few Missing Adventures as well.
He did The Shadow of Wang Chung.
Yes, yes. I've read a few of it. I didn't like when I first read his, and I'll be totally blunt, I really didn't like it. I think the first one I read was White Darkness, and I found it really hard going.
Right, I'll cross him off the list then.
Of his, and I've really enjoyed them, so...
Okay.
So it's one of those things where, you know, you've got to be careful you don't judge a book by its cover and its author, you know.
Yeah, sometimes
you'll find a book that you don't... I mean, it's the same with Paul Cornell. I found No Fear. Is it No Future, really hard as well. Yeah, I found virtually all his others really easy and accessible.
I really like No Future. That was the first one that I bought, I think.
It's just exactly the example. Sometimes you've got to be very careful about judging authors on just one singular book.
Mm, mm.
Sometimes you can just find it could be just you or just the way that book's written. As you say, you found No Future to be brilliant. So it's not to say No Future is a bad book at all. But for some reason, it just didn't work for me on the level it worked for you. So, yeah, no, McKinty's a good author.
Definitely a strong author. I remember in First Frontier, I think they regenerated the Master as well. And there was the Dr. Benny and Ace, Future Ace, not TV Ace, sort of 25th mm-hmm. century Ace, in which he'd lived for a bit with Fighting Daleks. And the Master character... Obviously, the Master, and he regenerated it. I'm pretty sure he regenerated.
Yes, he does think.
Yeah, and there's also aliens. Now, I think probably the aliens are the weak point of the novel because they're looking back contextually, I suppose, because they're basically greys. There's nothing particularly interesting. Like, it's basically a bit of X-Files and a bit of Doctor Who kind of collided, and I think it's set in Area 51 as well. A lot of this is from memory. I haven't read it in a long time, so and it's by no means a bad book.
He also wrote The Dark Path, which deals with the origins of the Master.
Yes.
Which has him as a character. I think it was called something like Koshi, something like that. It was. I remember that one as well, and I really enjoyed that. I mean, that was actually quite a big one again, because it was actually showing you the Master before he suddenly goes mad and turns into the Master as this very nice character.
Hmm.
So, and Face the Enemy, I've always wanted to read, and I never got hold of it, which is very frustrating.
I think, isn't that the one where they haven't got the Doctor, so they use the Master?
Yeah, it's got Ian and Barbara and Harry in it as well, which is why I wanted to read it.
Right, yeah. Right, okay. Bear that in mind. Okay, so that's The Schizoid Earth, and also interestingly, it features an exclusive foreword by Amanda Haseman, daughter of Lethbridge creator Mervyn Haseman, in which she talks about her father and the legend he created for Doctor Who. Following that, we've got The Beast of Fang Rock by Andy Frankham Allen and a gentleman called Terence Dix, and followed by Mutually Assured Domination by Nick Walters. From what Terence said yesterday, Andy's doing all of the writing on that. So presumably there's a kind of an approved outline, and then Andy's doing the hard work on there. That's just an assumption I've made there. Don't take that as fact, anybody. So interesting stuff going on with that. It's good to see the series is continuing and getting over the fact that Lance Parkin isn't contributing, unfortunately, at this stage. I think we all look forward to some new Doctor Who from Lance, or some new Doctor Who related material from Lance Parkin, at least. Hey, do you know what?
What?
We're getting T-shirts.
Get the heck out.
Yeah, really, honestly, truly, we're getting T-shirts.
Get the heck out. Some of the biggest load of self-sanitizing I've ever heard. Get the heck out of here.
Oh, shut your face. We've done a deal with tpublic.com, and we've got a t-shirt store on tpublic. Now, the interesting thing about it, it's not just a t-shirt store, it's basically t-shirts which I think you should be wearing, dear listener. This is a curated T-shirt store. So I'm not basically, you know, they've got hundreds and hundreds of Dot 2 T-shirts, Dot 2 related, Dot 2 mashups, that kind of thing. And basically, I've filtered out the ones that I don't like, and I've only added in the ones that I think are worthy of the chest of a Casturbus listener. Okay? Now, no other website would think of you in this way, I don't think. No other website would give a damn whether you were wearing a T-shirt with one letter on it in the most god-awful font and colouring that cost you $20, or the most awesome image that cost you exactly the same price but was perfectly toned for the background and, you know, was a great design. So, and also, we're going to be doing some Casturbus T-shirts as well. So okay. If you want to walk around with the Casturbus logo on your chest and receive strange looks from ladies or gentlemen of the opposite or interested gender, then that's what you should wear, basically. In my humble opinion. Guys, will you be buying a Casturbus T-shirt?
No.
I'm very... It's nice, James, that we have to buy them rather than being part of the team.
No, you don't have
just
to buy
getting
them.
These gifts. No,
you
from,
don't have to
Christian
buy them.
Polly, you know? Now, don't say this now. Come on, knock it off. My father will want one. I can tell you that.
He's definitely not. He is not buying one after what happened last time. I'll hand deliver mine if I have to.
He would enjoy one, though, that's for sure. I'd love to see the designs you've come up with since you're springing us on us in a podcast, and I have no clue, dear listener, about these shirts that are happening.
Well, I'll tell you what. Do you know what the degree of my imagination is? The extent of my imagination is that the first one will be the Casturbus logo.
Whoa, stop right there. I don't know if people can handle that. No, that's cool. I think it's a good idea. I like it. I like the idea.
Good. Well, I'm glad you approve.
And then when I do panels at conventions and I tell everybody I'm from Casturbus, I can wear the band T-shirt like you're not supposed to do when you go see the band. But then it's free advertisement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the other thing that I had to report. Now, Doctor Who Series 9 news now. There isn't an awful lot to report. Although apparently there's something to do with Vikings. And Skaro. And Davros. As
wow,
a boy.
All in one place.
Yeah, well, we don't know. It's all getting a bit confused in the Doctor Who Series 9 discussion thing. You know, first we've got Khan, then we've got the Master Missy, then we've got some... Did someone say Ogrons as well, or did I dream that bit?
I haven't heard that. I wouldn't mind that, to be honest, but I haven't heard that.
I might have dreamt it. It's all getting a bit crazy. And then we've got a young Davros, according to the Mirror, who the Doctor decides to kill because he can now, because no time loss to stop him.
Yeah, because that worked so well, saving people in the Waters of Mars. But hey, go on.
Yeah, exactly. And then perhaps, you know, someone might turn up to stop him, perhaps some Daleks or perhaps a Master Missy person. So, yeah, all a bit confused there. And there's been a strong rumour. There hasn't been confirmation, but Doctor Who reported that David Schofield, who's been in the Vikings and he's been in loads of films and TV series, is playing a Viking king. He took over from Brian Blessed, who was apparently cast. But as you may know, he fell ill recently, did the great Mr. Blessed. So that's great. I thought that he was cast in Doctor Who again. It's really sad that he can't make a return appearance.
Yeah, I haven't actually heard that bit, so that is pretty sad.
Yeah, because I think we all like Brian Blessed. And you know, he's often a bit maligned for his shouting. Right? He's a far subtler actor than that in reality. Flash Gordon Brian Blessed, isn't there? The Flash Gordon, King Icarnos, or even Blake Seven Brian Blessed. And then there's the kind of the classical Brian Blessed, isn't there?
Yes.
There's a lot more considered.
Sweeney Brian Blessed, the Zed Cars.
Yeah, yeah.
Brian Blessed.
Yeah. Yes, so, yeah. It's a bit... No, go on.
Yeah.
And, of course, I saw him in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang as well. Sorry, James.
There we go.
He's
a theatrical actor, isn't he?
Yeah, oh, yeah. It's a nice history there.
What was he on stage in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang?
Yeah, he was. We saw the afternoon show. I think this was actually my first trip to the UK, so it was before I came out to see you guys.
Okay.
We saw an afternoon show or a matinee, I guess, if you call it that there. But he was very conscious of the fact that children might be scared of him playing the villain. So when he did the afternoon shows, he carried a teddy bear. And so when he would shout all his lines at the audience, or at the characters on stage, rather, excuse me, and play the big bad, he would then turn to the kids in the audience and give them like a silly smile and make the bear wave at them and do a little silly dance and so on to help make them not really be afraid of him, to help make them feel a little bit more comfortable with the show.
Right.
was really, really nice to watch, to be honest, that somebody thought to go to that level. Like, I really don't want to scare these children, but I want them to still have fun.
Okay. So who did he play?
I don't know the story well enough. I've only actually seen the story there, but he played the villain of the story, and I don't remember who that is. And that's a terrible thing to say, but I really don't know who that is in that movie.
Because there's kind of two, isn't there? There's the child catcher and there's the king. I see him more as a king.
Right. Yeah, I want to say he was the king too. I don't remember him as a child catcher. Matter of fact, I seem to think he was wearing a crown or something that would indicate that when I saw it.
Okay. Yeah, so yeah, we're missing out with some Brian Blessed in Doctor Who, which is a shame. Okay, recommendations time, chaps. We're a good deal through the podcast. We've had our little insert from the afternoon with Terence Dicks talking about Mac Hulk earlier. So, recommendations. Who would like to go first? I went first last week.
I can go. I'm looking up Brian Blessed right now. Baron Bomburst is who he played.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds like the king-esque character. Okay, so
sounds
your recommendation.
Like a name I'd love to hear him say again. But anyway, yeah, I'll go first. I've just finished season one of Twin Peaks. I've never seen it before. I've heard people talk about it for years. And, it was always the big mystery was who killed Laura Palmer. I don't know if you guys are familiar with it, but here it was like, even if you didn't watch Twin Peaks, you knew the name Laura Palmer and that there was a big mystery surrounding her death with this show. But I had no idea what the show was like. I had no idea what to expect of it at all. I thought it was more serious, but with some twisted stuff happening in it. And not to say that it isn't serious, but I don't know if you guys have ever watched Northern Exposure. But a lot of U.S. viewers would know that when I say this, it's kind of like Northern Exposure, but with a serious murder plot going on in the middle of it. Like, it's a small town. There, everybody is wacky, including the FBI agent who comes to the town. Everybody's just a character. It's like the weirdest kind of thing. And everybody in the town is connected. They're all having affairs with each other. They're all pulling off some kind of evil plot connected to drugs and murder, arson, or what have you. It's not at all, like I said, what I expected when I started watching it. I decided, I guess, based on the news that it was getting a revival, you know, maybe I should check it out and see what it's like. And considering it's only got like a season and a half, the first season was 8 episodes long. Maybe I'll give it a go. And it was weird because I wasn't expecting much, but the pilot episode made you sit there and go, wow, this is nuts. I need to see that next episode. And each episode just keeps getting more interesting, but it's not really, I can't say that the show is indicative of the era that it was filmed in, because it's made very stylistically. It's made very intentionally to have these people and the scenes as weird or as strange as they can be. So it was intentionally made to be this kind of just wacky film or TV series or whatever. So I'm very curious to see if the revival can keep that going. But based on the strengths of season one alone, I would recommend the series so far. It's been quite interesting.
Okay.
Have either of you seen it?
Yeah.
No.
James, I thought you might have. Yeah. Did you like it?
Yeah, I did. I thought it was a very good. It's a very good series. I think it definitely needs a revival. I think it's one of those few series where I think you could genuinely say it needs to have some sort of coda to it.
Nice.
So yeah, no, it's a great series. If you've not seen it, you should. It is very wacky. It never stops being slightly crazy, and it's got a lot of charming characters in it, a lot of charming actors playing these very dark characters, maybe is a better way of putting it. Yeah,
and there's a thing, too, where like some of the characters could very easily go over the top, but they don't. And in many cases, they'll downplay it. Some of them can, and some of them do go over the top. That's certainly in there. I don't want to give too much away, but there was a character who gets shot, and they do like a whole, maybe like 5 to 10 minute sequence of the guy just lying on the floor trying to get help, but an old man comes in the room to try and help him, and he has no understanding of what's going on. He just thinks he's talking to the new guy in town, and he, the guy's just trying to tell him, "I've been shot, get a doctor," and it's just 5 minutes of a misunderstanding, and the guy on the ground, he's not screaming, he's not in agony, he's not yelling. It was the strangest scene, but it was funny and cool and wacky. And yeah, I agree. I think the show definitely does deserve a revival, especially if they never resolved the plot line. It would be nice to get that. But I don't know. I'm not finished the series yet. So, but I'm with you. It was a very good show.
Okay. I'll go next. I have... where do we start? Game of Thrones is back. So that started last week, and if you're in the United States, you've already watched 2 episodes by the time I've watched it. In fact, if you're in anywhere that isn't the United Kingdom and you're a Game of Thrones fan, you've probably watched the first 2 episodes by the time I record this, and I'm still waiting to see the second one, because here in the UK we get the episodes like a day after the rest of the world. Boo-hoo. So, Game of Thrones started strongly.
First world problems.
Yeah, I know, but it's a first world podcast, so what do you expect? And
try being
so
a Doctor Who fan when the new series came back, by the way, in America.
Yeah, I know. Totally yeah. Bad. Totally
first
bad.
World problems. Yeah. Come on now.
Yeah.
You don't know them.
Terrible. But what I've been watching mostly is One Foot in the Grave, Series 4. So this is the one... I can't recall which year it's from. Basically, do you remember there's the episode where they're sat in traffic for the entire episode?
I'll stop you now. No.
Okay, there's an episode where Victor, which is Richard Wilson from The Empty Child, Margaret, who is Annette Crosby, who's in The 11th Hour, and Mrs. Wildboys, who's a random actress name I can't remember, are sat in traffic for the entire episode, and the episode... like the final part of the episode is Victor deciding to put in a tape after having mentioned how many times he's had the car back sent to the garage and back again. Puts in a tape he finds on the dashboard, and there are mechanics singing a song about him. And the lead voice is Eric Idle of the Pythons. Hi. And what's that noise?
We'll just ignore that noise.
Okay.
My girlfriend in the other room, forgetting she needed to be quiet for the hour. But anyway,
okay. So that's a good, quite a memorable One Foot in the Grave episode. And there's also the following episode where there's a similar idea where they go out for a trip and accidentally end up, Victor and Mrs. Wallboys end up with their feet accidentally cemented together. I can't tell you any more than that. You'd have to watch it to see. Absolutely hilarious series. The fact that they were all written by... every episode was written by the same guy, David Renick, is in stark contrast to modern sitcoms, which struggle to have a single writer produce amusing material throughout a single episode, never mind an entire series. So a testament to strong characters and strong performances there. So my recommendation is Series 4 of One Foot in the Grave. Always funny. James, your turn.
Oh, my recommendations. My recommendation this week is... let me roll a dice. The Invasion... no, RoboCop.
RoboCop?
Yes.
Original or remake?
The original. It's about a cybernetic... being that breaks out and invades London in multitude. No, that's Invasion. It's satirical.
RoboCop?
Yes, it's a satirical. It's partially satirical science fiction film from 1987. I was doing a paper on it and I watched it far too much. Mm-hmm. I've seen it many times before.
I'd buy that for $1.
Exactly. It's just an amazing film on so many levels. I got the director's cut, which is very funny because the director's cut is simply the same film, but with like an extra 2 minutes of blood. There is no subtlety to the director's cut. But it is just a very, very good film. It's got absolutely nothing to do with Doctor Who. I can't think of any connections to Doctor Who in it whatsoever at all.
Cybernetic upgrades.
Apart from the Cybermen. If you don't know much about the Cybermen, obviously I recommend The Invasion and all that sort of stuff. RoboCop, it is a very good film. I mean, I found it very interesting comparing it to the adaptation, the 2014 one. There's a lot of interesting changes going on there. The original has got a great soundtrack. I mean, interestingly enough, Verhoeven says he was partially inspired by Metropolis. And if you listen to the original soundtracks of Metropolis and you listen to RoboCop, you can feel there are similarities there. There's a lot of homages going on in RoboCop. And of course, Judge Dredd, which is hilarious. I say hilarious because it's not even funny, but it is hilarious on the special features where they talk about the inspirations to RoboCop, and the screenwriters talk about going through Marvel comics and coming to the decision they wanted to do a film which was basically the superhero with a headache theme, as they call it. They don't mention Judge Dredd at all once, which if you've read Judge Dredd or you've seen the Judge Dredd film or films, you'll probably see certain similarities to RoboCop.
If you've even seen a photo of Judge Dredd holding a gun.
Absolutely. I mean, if you're aware of the actual actual comic and you read the satire and the darkness in the comic is there in RoboCop. And then they show some shots of earliest shots of the suits as being done by the modeler. And one of the early ones is literally RoboCop with Judge Dredd's helmet on. It is literally his helmet. And they sort of say at one point, it looked a bit like Judge Dredd very early on. No, that's Judge Dredd's helmet you stole in there. Incredible how close that film was. So if you wanted a British context, RoboCop, you've got Judge Dredd there. It's a very good film. It's one that I assume that everyone's seen, but now, you know, we're looking at it being like 1987, it's almost 30 years old, isn't it? There's going to be a lot of people who probably haven't seen it. And it's a very hard watch. It's a very funny watch. I mean, the beginning bit, I remember seeing as a kid where the corporate guy gets blown apart, literally, by one of the Ed 209 series in the corporate office in front of all his corporate mates. You know, there's nothing left of him. There's that wonderful line straight after it where you hear someone saying, it's one of those crowd voices, you know, someone call a paramedic. There's just nothing left of this guy. And it's a brilliantly clever film. Verhoeven, I think, is a very underrated director, given, you know, how much damage Star Trek Troopers got thrown at it, which is doing exactly the same thing as RoboCop. And strangely enough, RoboCop was never seen as a right-wing film, and yet Star Trek Troopers... people miss the whole satire on supporting fascist protagonists. Yeah. And it's incredible. Same director, same signature. And yet the two films, the critics missed the whole point of one, but managed to capture the whole point of the other. So yeah, so seriously, yeah. RoboCop's my recommendation. Other than that, I've been watching Battlestar Galactica again, which I think we've talked about so many times, I didn't feel that people could cope with me mentioning it again.
Okay. So, speaking of remakes, I saw the trailer for the new Fantastic Four.
Oh, go yeah. On. Now, should we just mention before you do Fantastic Four the Star Wars trailer?
No, we'll do that. After.
That sort of explode. You want to do Fantastic Four first? Do we have to
do Fantastic Four first?
It's terrible. Yeah. Go on.
Well, that's what I thought. Now, I know that there are problems with the original two Fantastic Four films, but certainly the first one, the second one is a little bit kind of, it goes into that kind of darkness territory with the Silver Surfer, but kind of holds together reasonably well. The first one's really good, I thought. This trailer, I like the casting, but the whole characterization is way out for me from the trailer. You know, Jamie Bell?
That's a familiar name, but I don't know him.
I think he's in one of those films about people who can move through space and time. He was also Billy Elliot. He's also from my neck of the woods as well. Now, he's Ben Grimm. You know, he's just a slip of a lad, really. And he's just,
casting is all wrong.
I think it's different. I don't know whether they made it different because it suits being different, because the contentious bit is Johnny Storm is now black, And if they've got the best guy for the part, then that's fair enough. But also his father's black for obvious reasons. There's the father in there, so that seems like a determined decision to kind of rewrite the aspect of it all. Now, some of the special effects I've seen in the trailer look quite good, and the whole idea of it being a trans-dimensional thing rather than a space voyage with radiation causing their special powers is an interesting kind of switch around. But I just felt it just seemed a very, very, very dark and gloomy trailer to me, whereas the original ones had more of a kind of atmosphere of X-Men and Spider-Man.
This is what I was saying with the problem with the leaked Batman versus Superman trailer, is that it sort of shows to me an underlined underconfidence with the material when you feel that you need to... it almost sort of becomes a... With the Batman and Superman thing, it's the same sort of thing. Superman's very dark. There's all these questions about Superman being almost like a god. How would people be uncomfortable with him? And it almost feels like in that trailer, as if they're sort of saying, we're almost sort of like metatextually sort of saying, hey, we're a little uncertain that audiences would be convinced by Superman as he has been in the comics over 50 years. And almost like our narrative is reflecting that by all the people in the film being worried about Superman being... they can't accept him unless he's really dark. It feels like that with the Fantastic Four, is that they're too scared to allow Fantastic Four to be the film to reflect the legacy in the same way the same as Superman feels. They feel scared to try and go out there and try and do what would be a far more difficult film, to try and get a film which is relevant to now but reflects the legacy. They managed it with Spider-Man. I mean, in the 90s, no one thought they would be able to do a Spider-Man spinning his web through New York in a blue and red suit and it not look odd. Everyone thought it'd have to go like the Batman route to be dark, broody, with rubber and, you know, armour, and because they couldn't imagine it. And it just feels like Fantastic Four and Superman are sitting on this scared level where they don't really want to try and embrace the difficulties of both projects.
This is the Doctor Who on BBC Two thing, isn't it? This is the Doctor Who mimicking the X-Files comeback, sort of, not being confident with the material.
Yeah.
And everything that comes with it, yeah. Okay, Star Wars. Trailer number two. You've got nothing to say about it?
No, I think everyone has said everything about it, but I think naturally people want everyone to keep talking about it regardless.
So are we going to stop talking about it? Because my wife's grandfather told me that the trailer alone had made $2 billion, according to one newspaper, which maybe it's had 2 billion views. I'm not sure if it's made $2 billion.
The trailer certainly is one of those things where it made it very difficult to look at things like Facebook all day because every post was just about it. Yeah. Not that that's a bad thing. It's fine. It's a thing that people really enjoy rather than something stupid like the color of a dress. But it does. It's one of those things where I can honestly say, like, I'm genuinely interested in checking out the film, whereas unlike the Fantastic Four, which I'm not. I'm not really into the Fantastic Four, and if they could do a good movie about it, cool, I'll check it out if it's good and or if it makes sense. But I don't want to watch something like the Fantastic Four and then have Marvel go, hey, guess what, we got the rights back, all those films you just watched, now they're null and void because now we're bringing them into our universe and only the ones in our universe matter, like they're doing with Spider-Man, which it's cool he's back, but now the other two movies which are really good are just, they don't count, so I can't get hyped up for something like that. But for Star Wars, I didn't like the prequels. And no. I'm glad Lucas is not a part of these. And I think J.J., going by the trailer, seems to have made at least an interesting-looking film. I am one of those people that I don't care if everybody's older. I'm glad to see the other characters back, even if they're only in the first film. So I'll admit, when I saw the trailer, yeah, made me happy to see a lot of those things. It actually made me happy to see how Star Wars it actually did feel. Obviously, though, seeing the movie will be a completely different experience. So trailer alone, it was kind of neat. Seeing the movie, who knows what it'll be like.
James?
I think what I found it was amazing on almost like a social landmark level. Because the funny thing with film and television is that people tend to sort of dismiss it when really events like this, social events like this, tell you so much about society. I mean, how that had such a global response. That moment was a global surge that you just don't get through history. And I know it's just a silly film, as people would say, but it's a film which has affected generations. It brings people together in a way that nothing else does. You know, it's profoundly crazy. It boggles my mind sometimes. You know, as you say, Facebook's now just full of pictures of Han Solo.
It's the difference between the reception to the two trailers as well. That's the absolute what you were talking about before. That's a confident film. And then the Fantastic Four one or the Batman Superman one, which I haven't seen yet, as you mentioned before, there's no confidence in the material.
Absolutely. I mean, to be fair, some would say cynically, and fair enough, they would say that the second Star Wars trailer just really is what they call these days, thanks to Doctor Who, fan wank, being where okay. the term was coined. It does rely on the fact that it knows that people watching this are excited about Doctor Who, about these old characters appearing. But that's part and parcel of it. It's a funny thing. It's a scary thing at the moment because in some sense it's wonderful, in some sense it's not. In some sense it's perpetuating the reboot sequel phenomenon that's happening on television and in film, where there becomes this reliance on older material, which is great if you love older material like we do. But sometimes you think, you know, how much new material is not being seen or not being considered because we are now so consumerist, we just want to have stuff that we've seen before, essentially, again. And that worries me a little, you know, not too worrying. But do you know what I mean? It's it is sort of scary that everything is, and now globalization is creating, you know, things like Fast and Furious 7. Is making more money than its previous versions. I mean, when did that happen? When sequels started to invert the box office figures?
Netflix, probably.
Well, Netflix, you know, globalization again, you know, getting a lot more interest in China and the likes, which is boosting box offices. America, as we've said before, looks at box offices now globally more. You know, these things are changing, and it's fascinating. With the Star Wars thing, I must say, I really liked, as you said, the fact that you feel that Abrams knows the films better than Lucas does. Small things, and I think Brian will like this, is things like the lightsaber, which is passed over to Leia in the trailer, has the D-clip on the end.
Sure, yeah.
Which they use in the old trilogy. In the new trilogy, they did the buckle clip.
They were like cell phone clips or something, you know? Yeah.
Huh? Yeah.
They were cell phone clips. It was such a weird thing, yeah.
It was to obviously stop it from knocking into the actors in ways which was uncomfortable in for the old trilogy. Yeah.
Plus, you know,
testicular areas. But that sort of note, that attention to detail, which wasn't there when they sort of transferred over the lightsaber between the Revenge of the Sith and New Hope. You know, it's just tiny things like that, which just make you feel this guy knows what he's doing. He's letting people do what they have to do.
And I'll tell you that the thing that actually first got me in the trailer was the opening. And the reason I say that is because first thing we see is what looks like a land speeder just going across the desert. And my actual thought was, oh God, not again. Like, we're going to go back to Tatooine. Are we like, do we really need to, you know, like we've already done that to death. And then I looked to the right of that screen, and that's when I noticed the Star Destroyer crashed into the planet. And that's when I got interested. And it was like, here's this image that they're showing us. And I'm just like, wow, you really, it's just that kind of samey old imagery. And then bam. And I was like, wow, okay. I should pay attention a little bit more. And that's when I started to get the fan excitement going. And obviously, you know, of course, it's nice to see Chewie and Han at the end. I thought that was great, of course. But, you know, I thought there was a lot of good stuff in there.
Do you find that a little hard? I mean, I was saying to someone that I find that you get so many parodies now of older characters by actors. That you get so used to seeing it on YouTube, you know, Saved by the Bell or William Shatner or Michael Keaton recently on Saturday Night Live turning to the camera and doing I'm Batman, you know, and you get these sort of moments that I could almost not believe that it was meant to be Han Solo, but a parody, Harrison Ford parodying Han Solo for Jimmy Kimmel or someone.
I will say that I did think that it was one of those scenes that was specific to the trailer and maybe that scene would play differently, but it's also... you know, them walking out and saying, I'm back, it's great for the fans to go, ooh, wow, they're back, look at that. But it, all that really could mean is that Chewie and Han were on a mission for the Republic, and, you know, it took them a little bit longer than expected, and now they're back and they're happy, you know. But fans are, it's a perfect thing to throw at the end of the first official Star Wars trailer, you know. That shows could footage.
I found that bit quite jarring, to be honest with you, because you got all this new stuff, and then you have this old guy. Yeah, Harrison Ford and Harrison Ford fans. He's an old guy.
Yeah, but you know, I like that because you have... that's what they should have done with the prequels. We shouldn't have gone backwards, because anything you were going to do in the past to try and build up to the original three Star Wars movies, I think was destined to fail, because the technology just wasn't there to go ahead and make that happen.
Well, they wouldn't have been prequels if they hadn't.
And you needed the storytelling to do it properly, and anything that you could tell wasn't going to be as good as our imaginations, because everybody's vision of it is different. But any stories that you can tell afterward are better. And I like the fact that they're introducing a whole cast of characters that we're supposed to get to know, because I don't really feel that Luke, Leia, and Han are going to have massive parts in all three films.
Yeah.
Maybe they're in all three, but they're certainly not going to be that big. Maybe some of them are only in the first one, you know? And I'm okay with that. And I think that's good, and that's a great handover. And I know the first, the newer prequel three did have a cast of characters that were in the original trilogy. But you had to recast all of them, obviously. And it just, I don't know. I wanted to like them. I didn't like them. I liked certain things about them. You know, maybe this will be the same way. Who knows? But something about seeing them at the end, I agree, it was a little bit jarring. But at the same time, it was one of those things where I don't care. It was Han and Chewie. That was cool for that thing. To see how it plays in context with the film is going to matter more than how it played in context of a trailer.
Yeah. Okay. Well, go on then.
I was just going to say, I can't remember what I was going to say. I was just going to say something about it being, you know, Star Wars is about generations and older Han Solo shouldn't bother people, etc. I don't know why. Ignore me. Carry on. What were you saying?
Okay. So that brings us to the end of this week's Cast Overs podcast with a K. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for our wide-ranging discussion this week, which kind of took in Star Wars and the Fantastic Four, Terrence Dix, One Foot in the Grave and Doppelganger in a kind of a strange sci-fi mix-up. When, you know, really we're here to talk about Doctor Who. If there wasn't enough Doctor Who for you in this podcast, I suggest you go and listen to all of the other podcasts, where I'm sure you'll have enough Doctor Who to listen to. And next week, we will be discussing...
What will we be discussing? What?
Time and the Rani.
We've waited how many years to do this?
I'm not sure waited is the right word. Until then, it's goodbye.
Waiting. It's the only reason I'm here.